Well, welcome again once again to the Mike Wilson Show on WWGH. My guest today, I'm waiting for a phone call from, and that is going to be Fred Malone, and he should be calling any second now. Remember that you can listen to WWGH Radio live on any mobile device by downloading the free TuneIn app and searching WWGH. And that is probably Fred calling right now. Let's find out. Hello, Fred? Hold on just a second. Let me push a button.
Okay, you should be on the air.
Oh, good. We're there already.
I'm there already, yes.
Well, how are you?
I'm just fine. This is Fred Malone, the history extraordinaire. And I have no idea what we're going to talk about today, but Fred is always fascinating. So, Fred, what are we going to talk about?
Well, we're going to talk about the creation of the Marion City School System today.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but before we do that, I wanted to kind of bring everybody up to speed on what was happening with the three organizations that I'm pretty actively involved in. Just with the pandemic, the COVID-19 is going on right now. A lot of things obviously have been closed down. My dog's barking here. Hang
I
on
hear him.
A second.
He wants to be on the air, doesn't he?
We're on the air. Quit that now, honey. Come here. With everything that's going on with the COVID-19 and all that right now, I thought I better bring everybody up to speed about what's open and what isn't open and what things are taking place and what aren't. So start out with the Marion County Historical Society. The museum is currently open. We did open the museum on July the 8th, and we're open for our normal hours, which are Wednesday through Sunday, 1 to 4 in the afternoon. We are observing all of the COVID-19 regulations, so you are obviously required to wear a mask when you come to visit the museum, and practice the social distancing. But the exhibit is open, and I must say that they've done a wonderful job this year with the exhibit. We're currently celebrating, of course, 2020, which was the year that Harding was elected president, and the first year that women were given the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So Florence Harding was the first lady that had an opportunity to vote for her husband for president. So the exhibit's very nice, very well done, so I encourage everyone to take advantage of coming down to visit us. And again, that's Wednesday through Sunday, 1 to 4. And you are also entitled, when you come to the museum, you're entitled to the Wyandotte Popcorn Museum. So you're really getting two museums for the price of one.
Just a question on that.
So that's the good news.
Okay.
With regard to what else is taking place there, Lynn School is not open and will not be open this year. Obviously, things were delayed originally because of the accident that took place last late fall, where the truck ran into the side of the building. The school is repaired. We still had a few things to do on the inside, but with the COVID-19 and the size of the school out there, it makes it virtually impossible to do proper social distancing,
right,
and that type of thing. Plus, we wanted to really have a grand reopening, you know, with a big crowd and you know, some speeches and things like that, which obviously you can't do with this pandemic going on. So we're planning at this point in time is reopening Lynn School next spring, and at that time we'll probably set a grand reopening celebration maybe sometime in the early part of the summer when we can have a lot of folks out and they can tour the reconstruction of the Lynn School.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, we are still planning to go ahead with the First Ladies Luncheon, which is to take place August the 10th. We do have tickets available. We will be practicing social distancing, and we've worked it out with the caterer so that the meal can be served to you. Obviously, we can't do buffet lines anymore, but you can actually go through a line, point to what you want, and they'll plate the dinner for you. So we're still planning to do that. If you're interested in that, you can call the museum at 740-387-4255. Or you can go online at marionhistory.com and find further information on that.
Now, what time of day is that?
I'm sorry?
What time of day is that?
It's a luncheon, and it's on a Saturday, and we normally start the lunch at 11:30.
Okay.
So, again, at this point in time, we're planning to go forward with it. Now, obviously, there are a couple of caveats there. If for some reason we we don't sell the minimum number of tickets that we need to sell, and that's 75, we would probably have to cancel the event. If we don't have at least 75 people, it doesn't make it, you know, a profitable event for us. So,
right.
But we're planning. Same way with the President's Dinner, which is the first Saturday in November, and I think that's either the 7th or the 8th. Off the top of my head, I don't remember, but it's always the first Saturday in November. And we're planning to go ahead with that. Again, that has been cut from 300 people down to 150. And that's, of course, to keep proper social distancing and that type of thing and serving and all that. So if you're interested in that, same thing, 740-387-4255, or go on MarionHistory.com and you can get further information on that. Unless, again, we can't sell enough tickets to make it worth our while, and we would probably try to not make a final decision on that until sometime in, you know, I'm going to say mid-October. But right now we're planning to go ahead with it, and I know they have sold some tickets. That brings you up to date on Marion County. Mohawk Historical Society up in Sycamore. The museum is currently closed and will probably remain closed for the balance of this year. We just completed the addition of a new building that was built onto the existing museum, and that's done and ready to go. But again, with COVID-19 and the problems that that has created, and also with the rising numbers that we're seeing now with COVID and some of the problems that are running into, and I think 19 counties now in Ohio that are under the mask order, and with the governor speaking again tomorrow about possibly a statewide mandate, we've just decided to stay closed, and we'll have a grand opening sometime in 2021. So nothing going on now. All programming has been called off for the year up there as well. Malabar Farm, the farm has remained open throughout the entire COVID problem. And when I say it's been open, the trails have been open, both the walking trails for people and the equestrian trails for the horse people. Those have remained open. And, of course, the park has been open where people can come out and walk around. But the house is closed. The visitor center is closed. And I just got word the other day that our big annual event, which is always the last weekend in September, Ohio Heritage Days, has been canceled, and that's a state event. So they've pulled the plug on that. And barn dances are now canceled for the balance of the year as well.
Okay.
So things pretty much are shut down over there, with the exception, again, of, you know, you can go over and walk the trails and just take in the beautiful outdoors and walk around the barns and that type of thing. It's possible that the visitor center may open around the middle of August. I don't have a definite date on that, but right now the visitor center is closed as well. So that kind of brings, I think, everybody up to date with the three organizations that I'm pretty actively involved in, and try to, you know, get people to go as much as they possibly can whenever I get the opportunity to talk to one of you guys on WWGH. So,
mm-hmm.
Questions?
No questions. Now I know, obviously, the car show at Malabar has been canceled.
Yeah, right. That was,
when
that
was that usually?
In July. That was the first Sunday in July. Obviously, okay. That got canceled early on.
Yeah.
We knew that was a big event, which, you know, obviously, we had somewhere around 300 and some cars last year, and we hated to cancel it, but unfortunately, there was no way you could social distance there,
right,
obviously, with
right.
the crowds that we got. And the state, again, you know, we couldn't use the state facilities like the visitor center or have tours in the house. So, you know, it was an obvious decision. But hopefully all those things can go forward next year. At least that's everyone's hope, that we'll have a vaccine here available sometime either by the end of the year or the first of next year, and we can get people across the country vaccinated, and
we
can all
so.
Be safe again.
Most
maybe
certainly.
Get things back to what we're used to seeing. And I don't like to say the new normal, because hopefully this new normal isn't going to last, you know, all that much longer. I have to kind of hope that anyway, because of all the organizations that we're both involved in. So.
Right. Well, you know, but, what? I've never made it up to Mohawk yet.
Well,
obviously I'm not going to this year.
For the biggest part of the year. Well, it's been closed all year, obviously, because we do shut down in the fall. And are closed through the winter, and normally we try to open back up like the last of March or the first of April. And of course, with the COVID thing hitting in March, that completely shut that down.
Sure.
But we did go through with the construction, as I said, on our new building. So we now have three buildings that are all connected. So the museum is really looking good. I'm really excited to have it reopen again in 2021. And unfortunately, as I was telling Glenn Coba the other day when I was on his show, mm-hmm. Charlie was a charter member of Mohawk Historical Society. I think we're celebrating 25 or 26 years this year. And he had been at our grand opening when we opened the museum originally, and then when we redid the museum several years ago after we had a big water leak and a problem in there, we had Charlie up, and he did the rededication of the museum. And I had planned to have him for the re-rededication of the new museum and the new building this year, but of course, obviously, with COVID hitting and then Charlie's untimely death, we'll have to have him there in spirit only when we are open again in 2021. So.
And I'm sure he will be there in spirit.
He'll be there definitely in my heart. I can tell you that. And I know with the folks up at Mohawk, they loved him dearly, and I know their thoughts will be about Charlie when we do finally cut the ribbon on the new addition.
Certainly.
But anyway, that kind of brings everybody up to date. I wanted to get that housekeeping out of the way. And now we're going to talk about the Marion City Schools development. And this information was compiled by Randy Winland back sometime in the 90s when Randy used to teach a class for I think new people coming to Marion if you wanted to take this class. I think Glenn Coble told me he took a class on Marion history, and I don't know whether it was one that Randy taught or not, but I know my wife Terry took this class when she first came to Marion, and Randy was teaching it. So the information that I have tonight is courtesy of Randy Winland, and Randy has done an awful lot of work on a lot of different subjects.
Yes, he has.
In Marion, and mm-hmm. and is, between him and Carol Neidhart, and there's others obviously too, but I think the two of them have really, Carol, of course, having been born and raised here, knew a lot of the history firsthand because he lived here his whole life, mm-hmm. but Randy having spent his entire teaching career here and spent a lot of time researching Marion history and writing books about Marion history as well. You could really call him an expert in the field of Marion history. And he did, just most recently, here just within the last year, write that book about Crystal Lake, which
yes, I bought that book.
Is available up at the museum if anybody's interested in getting a copy of that. We do have copies of that. So, but anyway, this information is courtesy of Randy Winland. And we're going to start out with the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. Now, this was important because it set aside Section 16 of every township in the Congress lands for the maintenance of schools in that particular township. And it was actually dedicating 1/36 of all land in the state of Ohio for education. Now, Ohio, of course, entered the Union in 1803, and the U.S. government gave control of these lands to the state at that time when we officially had our Constitution and became a state. Until 1827, the land that was designated for schools was generally leased or rented, with the proceeds being used for school purposes. However, this wasn't sufficient, so the state government eventually gave permission to the townships to sell the land. Now, most of that Marion land sold between 1830 and 1840 for a grand total of $12,243. Now, this is in $1840.
Right.
If you translate that to today's dollars, that's probably millions.
I don't know
what the actual translation rate is, but I'm sure it would translate into the millions. The 1787 ordinance that we just mentioned earlier had no effect on the VMI, the Virginia Military District, or the U.S. military lands. However, Congress did give these townships land for educational use only, and those included back then the townships of Bowling Green, Green Camp, Prospect, and Waldo. Now, the first schoolhouses, interesting structures, they were very crude affairs, and they were all built after the same plan. So irregardless of what school you went to and what township, it's going to look the same. The schoolhouses were not built then by a contract and paid for by taxes, but by voluntary contributions and services of the residents of that particular district.
Mm.
They were constructed of logs, and they were usually unhewed logs. At one end of the building, there was a huge fireplace built, obviously important because they had no other source of heat
right.
in those days.
Mm-hmm.
There were low benches for the small boys and high benches for the big boys. Now, notice I haven't mentioned girls.
I noticed that.
These benches had no backs, and they were split from trees, obviously, and there wasn't always care taken to make sure that all the splinters were removed from these benches, so they weren't that comfortable to sit on.
So the students were the splinter removers.
Yeah, I think okay. the kids were. Along the walls were the writing desks, above which a log had been left out. This opening was covered with greased paper, and that's what served as a window.
Oh.
So, again, not particularly warm, and especially if you happened to sit pretty far away from the fireplace, you weren't going to get much heat. And I don't imagine that greased paper did a really good job of keeping out that cold winter air.
No, I'm sure it didn't.
Caps that the boys wore were hung on wooden pegs driven into the walls. In the opposite end of the room from the fireplace, the teacher sat on a high chair behind a high desk, and behind him was a plentiful supply of hickory switches.
Ooh.
Now, why do you suppose they had hickory switches?
I don't know. I'm sure all the boys were always perfect angels.
Well, at least you knew in those days they were going to get corrected for whatever they
That's
did
right.
incorrectly.
That's right.
The writing pens were, of course, quills, and those were always made and sharpened by the teacher. The books were not always uniform. In fact, any kind of a book might be used for the teacher to teach you how to read. The early school laws authorized taxation only to provide schoolhouses and to pay the fees of the children whose parents were too poor to pay them. They were, in fact, pauper schools instead of public schools because most of the kids' parents did not have the ability to pay any type of fee.
Okay.
No provision was made for fuel, furniture, or incidentals. The fuel was supplied by having a wood chopping each year, and every household was expected to lend a hand. Boy, this is real participation. Can you see the parents of today doing this?
Oh, my.
The property of non-residents could not be taxed for any school purposes. Now, this early legislation was the means of partially paying the teachers. And by the good old plan of boarding around, the school money was economized so as to provide school for several months during each year. Now, the Constitution of 1851 marked a decided advance when it declared, "The General Assembly shall make such provision by taxation or otherwise," and I'm quoting directly from the Constitution, "as with the income arising from the school trust system will secure a thorough and efficient system of common schools throughout the state." Think that plan might work today?
I think it's worth a try.
Yeah. That quote came from the 1907 Marion County History, and it was, again, part of the Ohio Constitution of 1851.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Marion's first efforts began with Eber Baker, and of course we all know who Eber Baker was. He basically was the person that platted the village of Marion,
right.
setting aside certain lots for school purposes. The first school in the village was built in 1824 and was also used for a city meeting place and a church on occasion. Now, prior to 1851, the village was divided into small districts, with each area operating its own school, but in a very intermittent manner. The first truly organized effort at providing education was the development of the Marion Academy. Now, have you heard of the Marion Academy before?
Someplace along the line I have, yes.
Yeah, I'd heard somewhat about it, but I really wasn't too familiar with it until I read this information. On March the 16th of 1838, a bill was passed in the state legislature incorporating the Marion Academy for the purpose of education only. Now, I'm not quite sure what they were excluding when they say for the purpose of education only, but that's what was in the incorporation articles.
Hmm.
10 of the most influential Marion Village residents pooled their resources and authorized the first sale of stock in the company and hired the first instructor. Now, nowhere in my research or in Randy's information could I find who those influential people were in the community, but I'm sure Eber Baker and possibly Florence Harding's father may have had a hand in this, because they were probably some of the most wealthier people in the community at the time. The academy officially opened on December the 21st of 1840 with John J. Williams, a graduate of Franklin College, which was here in Ohio, as the principal. And I'm kind of wondering if that wasn't maybe a forerunner to the Franklin University that we have in Columbus now, or Columbus State possibly. I don't know, but I'm just guessing. The following announcement appeared in the Saturday Visitor and Marion Intelligence newspaper on December the 19th of that same year, which was 1840. And I'm quoting, "This institution will commence its first session in this place on Monday morning next. The branches that will be taught are the following: arithmetic, English grammar, geography, natural philosophy, chemistry, astronomy, geology, botany, algebra, Euclid's elements," and I have no idea what Euclid's elements were. I've heard of Euclid, but I don't know what his elements were. "Logic, rhetoric, mental and moral science." I think we could use a little bit of that in today's school.
Yes, we could. Yes.
"Political economy, evidence of Christianity." Can you imagine teaching that today?
Oh, my.
"Latin and Greek." Now, that's quite a curriculum. "Together with exercises of writing, reading, and the art of composition." I think we need to teach composition today. "The terms per session of 5 months for the lower branches specified are $6.50, and rating from that to $10, and the other branches are included. The location of the house is in the central and convenient part of town. Every attention will be given by the subscribers to render this institution one of a respectable character, and if it be sufficiently patronized by the community, it is hoped that will be a lasting utility to the town and the country. In the spring, another gentleman is expected to be on to assist." So they had the original instructor, and then hopefully they were going to add another one in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
"Especially in the mathematical department, and then also we shall have an opportunity to enlarge our apparatus from the east." Now, that's what was in the newspaper, the quote that was in the newspaper. "After meeting for the first year in the old Masonic Hall, the academy moved to the old stone block on the west side of South Main Street. There were 115 students in attendance with four instructors and Mr. Williams." So it's already starting to grow. "In 1843, the academy moved into its own building located in the 100 block of Oak Street." Now, I'm trying to visualize in that first block of Oak Street where this building may have been. I'm thinking that it isn't there anymore.
Right.
But the first block of Oak Street, there's not a whole lot there anymore, I don't believe.
I'm trying to picture where Oak Street is. So.
Yeah, well, Oak Street runs parallel to, what would that be, State Street? I think it runs parallel to State Street.
Okay.
Not State Street. The one over from State, Maine.
Okay.
I think it runs parallel with Maine.
Right.
Built at a cost of $2,448 by George H. Busby. That name sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm.
"The structure was made of brick and was two stories tall with two rooms in each level." And again, I'm going to have to take a drive over there one of these days and look and see if that building still is there in some fashion.
Now, Busby had a building downtown named after him, correct?
Right, he did. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, isn't it down... next to where the Busby Park is? Wasn't that building there before they created Busby Park?
I believe you are right.
I think that's where it was.
Yes.
A catalog describing the features of the academy relates that this institution is located in the center of a beautiful plain, a beautiful plain. So you know it's early.
Yes.
Containing about 7 acres of ground directly west of the town of Marion. So the town of Marion didn't go much farther since this is in the 100 block of Oak Street. The building consists of a spacious and elegant brick edifice with sufficient accommodations for 200 students. Quite a few.
Wow.
There is a good philosophical and chemical apparatus connected with the academy, sufficiently extensive for all practical purposes. The town of Marion is probably not surpassed by any in the state of Ohio for health and morality, and it is confidently believed that the conveniences for study and improvement are not excelled by any similar institution. Wow. Now, that's quite a statement.
It is.
Saying that the town of Marion is probably not surpassed by any in the state of Ohio for any health and morality. You think we could pass that test today? I'm not sure.
One question. Are girls still excluded at this
point? Still not included.
Okay.
I haven't run across at any point in this where girls were included.
Hmm.
The academic year was divided into two terms of 22 weeks each. Tuition was $3 per quarter for primary studies and $4 for natural, mental, and moral sciences, and $5 for mathematics and the languages. Getting kind of expensive.
Oh, wow.
Among the subjects taught were geography, grammar, arithmetic, and ancient and modern history by the English department, natural philosophy, chemistry, geology, mineralogy, botany, natural history, and astronomy by the Department of Natural Sciences, evidence of Christianity, natural theology, moral philosophy, political economy, intellectual philosophy, rhetorical logic, elements of criticism, and political grammar. That was all taught by the Department of Intellectual and Moral Sciences, Latin grammar, Latin reader, Caesar's commentaries, Cicero's select operations, Roman antiquities, Virgil, Cicero's De Sentire et De America, oh boy, that's a mouthful, Horace, Greek grammar, Greek reader, Testament, Homer's Iliad, the Gratia Major by the Department of Languages, and Algebra, Geometry, Trigonometry, and Surveying by the Department of Mathematics. Now, in all my education, most of that I never heard of.
Right. A question now, is this young men that were of what would now be high school age, or is this post-high school?
Well, no, I would assume that this is mixed, because they've got primary studies, they've got then natural, mental, and moral sciences, and then they've got grammar and arithmetic and that thing. So I'm going to say that you're probably talking youngsters that are maybe from 12, 13, up to 16, 17, maybe even 18 years old.
Okay. Wow, that's a lot to take
Again,
in.
Again, nowhere in here was it really clear, so I'm just kind of guessing there. After only a few years, the academy was a financial failure. I could see that coming. The owners attempted to sell it, but were stopped by a court order. Finally, after 3 years of legal battles, the building was sold at sheriff's sale on the 19th of August in 1854 to the recently formed Board of Education for the Village of Marion. Now, I think we're getting into more of the public realm. With this sale ended Marion's first attempt at public education. And I'm not sure, really, Mike, with what they were requiring with this academy, if that was really ever going to completely be profitable or completely be a success.
Well, you got to think, too, this was primarily a rural and farming community.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the academy was really providing an educational outsource for people of means, not people that were farming out in the county. Those really didn't start coming around until the one-room schoolhouses started popping up around the county. And that, we'll have to leave that for another time, because that's county schools and we're mainly talking about cities today.
Okay.
The Akron Law of 1847 was the basis for the next major development in the Marion school system, and I've never heard of the Akron Law of 1847 until I started doing this information. It provided for the election of one board of directors with control of the city and the attached territory. This board was to hold the authority to establish both primary and grammar schools in any district under its control. The system was proven so successful in Akron that the state legislature made it the basis of a state law in 1849. Now, the legislation enabled any village of more than 200 residents to organize a union school district and establish an adequate number of schools of various grades, which would be free to all white children of suitable age.
Mm-hmm.
White children. Marion soon took advantage of this new educational reform. Interesting that it only was to include white children. Marion Union Schools came into existence as a result of an election by the electors of the village of Marion at a public meeting on April the 19th of 1851. By a vote of 60-9, it was decided to have a village union school district. Six directors were subsequently elected, and I'm assuming this is like a school board, and an organizational meeting and election were held in May of 1851. This election was somewhat unique in that only 14 men in the entire village voted.
Okay.
Not too much interest there. The office sought the man, as only one of the six directors elected had voted. Three of those elected resigned quickly, two within 10 days of the election. W.L. Terrell was employed as the first principal or superintendent at a salary of $500 a year with a contract for 1 year only, and if he and the board could agree so, maybe longer. The former academy building was rented and then purchased 3 years later. Classes eventually moved to the Old Stone Methodist Episcopal Church, which was the Holt Salke building.
Okay.
At the northwest corner of the railroad and State Streets. The first union school building was contracted for in 1856. Now, this site was lots 7 to 12, inclusive, in Bennett and Fisher's addition, and the acre and a half immediately west of them. This is West Center and Oak Street area. Purchased at a cost of $4,750, the land was the site for the first actual building constructed by this union school system. Spacious brick structure of four stories with a belfry and considered one of the finest in the state. The new structure was surrounded by a dry moat, which helped provide ventilation for the lower floor. Now, I've never quite understood that dry moat system, other than this is the first that really I knew that anything about it was created for ventilation. The four major bills totaled $12,366. On August the 1st of 1857, E.B. Olmsted was appointed superintendent with a salary of $800 a year, with his wife becoming principal at a salary of $300 a year.
Okay.
So the two of them took in $1,100.
Wow.
This building was occupied until January of 1858, so only 2 years. The educational progress was slow at first, with the Civil War causing the first major disruption. Superintendent Olmsted enlisted at the start of the conflict and was promptly followed by nearly all the boys over the age of 18. So they all enlisted in the Civil War. That was when Lincoln made his call for that first, 100,000 men.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly thereafter, in 1864, and everybody will remember this, a smallpox epidemic closed the schools for several months. Remember the smallpox outbreak here in Marion?
Yes, I remember hearing of it. I wasn't there for it, but I
no,
remember hearing
no,
it.
No, well, we weren't, fortunately. And, of course, we still have smallpox victims buried in the cemetery over, what's the name of that street? Just off of Center Street. Finally, a three-year course of study was adopted in 1865 after the Civil War was concluded. Educational history was also made with the selection of Mrs. T.W. Cascaden as superintendent in 1868. According to the records that are available, it is believed that she was the first female superintendent of schools anywhere in Ohio.
Oh.
So that was a Marion first.
Yeah.
However, there is some discrepancy in terms of who the superintendent actually was. Some records show that she was, while others list Louisa Cope. Either way, it's a female.
Right.
In either case, the leader of the schools, there again, you know, she's a lady. The first graduating class followed in 1872, with the graduates being Charles C. Fisher and the first time I'm getting Elizabeth S. Ruhrmund as a student. So now we've got women entering.
Oh.
After that, a period of rapid growth for the school district began. Increased enrollment mandated, obviously, more space. And a new Marion High School building was constructed directly in front of the Union School. Completed in 1893 at a cost of $40,000, and the building had no equal in architectural beauty and school conveniences. Special rooms have been arranged for laboratories and the library. The chemical laboratory was accommodation for 16 pupils with individual workspace. Each desk was supplied with reagent bottles, a pneumatic trough, test tubes, beakers, in fact, everything necessary for general chemical work and an elementary course in quantitative and qualitative analysis. By the efforts of the pupils, money has been raised and about 200 books were placed in the library. Excuse me. Now we're going to move along pretty quickly here with the years as they pass by. And I see we've got about, what, 11
minutes?
10 minutes. Other significant events included: in 1877, North State Street School was completed, abandoned in 1930, and it was then used for civil defense offices in World War II, and it's now the site of the Taft Middle School. And by the way, this information was compiled in 1998, so a lot of this information is 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
1884, South Prospect Street, or the Lincoln School, was completed. That was used for grades 1 through 3, only after Pearl Street School was built in 1913 and abandoned in 1930. Remodeled in 1936 for use as the Marion City Schools Administration Building, abandoned again in 1971 and torn down in 1974, made into a parking lot. 1888 was the Greenwood Street School. It was abandoned in 1953, torn down in 1964. Now the site of the Marion Public Library.
Oh, okay. Okay.
1892, music is added to the curriculum. 1893, Silver Street School was completed. Additions were made in 1911, 1949, and 1955. And in 1963, the original and the 1911 additions were torn down and a new building constructed attached to the later additions. And I think that's all still in place down on Silver Street.
Okay. Yes, I think it is.
1894, three literary societies were formed. The Webster, Longfellow, and Irving societies met twice monthly on Friday afternoons. In 1897, the Whittier Society joined the competition for school prominence. And this was the time when we were having that whole transcendental movement going through the country, when people were really interested in poetry and transcendental thoughts and meditations and that type of thing. Also in 1894, the first public meeting held in the new Marion High School was the graduation exercises for the class of 1894. 1897, the first school publication was issued. The Forum served as a commencement bulletin and a yearbook and contained all of the senior class members' final orations. In 1898, David Street was completed, abandoned in 1931 and torn down in 1940, and that site was sold to the Marion Power Shovel Company.
Uh-huh.
Also in 1898, track meets, the first sport in Marion schools, began with Will Wyant as a trainer. And also the instruction in German was added to the curriculum, and that's kind of important because there were a lot of German immigrants that settled in Marion and Marion County. A lot of them came after the Civil War, but even some before that.
Mm-hmm.
In 1899, a thoroughly and systematically equipped gymnasium was constructed. Since every boy of high school age finds himself brimming over with physical energy. Boy, that's still true today, isn't it? And however good his intentions, sometimes finds himself leaping over the bounds of good order in the schoolroom, simply because his energies demand an outlet for themselves, and that was a quote.
Okay.
So they built that developed that just to kind of burn off some of that young energy. Also in 1899, Forest Lawn School was completed, abandoned, and torn down in 1954, and that was in 98, the site of the administration building. And the building, I think those buildings are still down there. The earnest solicitation of teachers and generous response of citizens succeeded in raising $115 for the purpose of buying pictures for the new high school building. Also in 1899, the Mandolin Club was formed under the direction of Professor Becker, a graduate of the Royal Conservatory Music at Leipzig, Germany. In 1990, polo and basketball teams were introduced to the school system.
1990?
In 1901, football games were held at the Marion Fairgrounds. Marion's record for that first season was 4 wins and 5 losses.
Okay.
In 1903, the first senior play was presented. In 1905, the Olney Avenue School was completed. The oldest remaining school in the Marion City system was gutted by fire in 1914 and rebuilt in 1915 using the original shell. And in addition to that, school was completed in 1956. In 1907, the Oak Street School was completed, abandoned and torn down in 1965. At the same time, a new building was constructed on another portion of the site and occupied the same year, and I think that building is still standing, if my memory serves me. 1910, the first choir at Marion High School was organized. First band uniforms were issued in 1922. 1911, Mark Street School was completed. Marion's first fireproof school had additions built in 1930 and 1955, with a major renovation in 1979, and I think that school is gone now. 1911, also, Oakland Heights School was completed, and additions added to that in 1924 and 1955. A lot of people, this will be an important date for them. In 1912, the first issue of The Quiver was published.
Oh.
And I think Marion is still publishing The Quiver. I think their yearbook is still called The Quiver.
I believe you're right on that, yes.
It was issued quarterly, was the approximate size of today's football program, and contained about 30 pages per issue. The name Quiver had a deeply symbolic meaning. In old times, every good hunter had his quiver well filled with arrows, and thus the quiver would be filled with the stories, jokes, and contributions of students, their arrows.
Okay.
The issue at the end of the year was always a larger one, a kind of commencement issue, and became the forerunner of the present yearbook. Also in that same year, industrial arts was added to the curriculum. 1913, Pearl Street School was completed. Used for grades 4 through 8. An addition was made in 1930 to house grade 1 through 6 when the Union School was abandoned, and another addition was made in 1954. 1914, Glenwood School was completed. 1915, the second Marion High School was completed on West Church Street at Orchard. Shortly after this, the Union's building faced condemnation. To forestall such action, the cupola and the third floor were torn off and a new roof installed. In 1921, a passageway was constructed to connect the old Union building and the high school, which then became Central Junior High School, one of the first junior high schools in the state of Ohio. And I don't think we're going to make it through the balance of this.
Yes, we have 3 minutes.
The first newspaper of the Marion Public Schools was printed with Edgar Barnhart as editor-in-chief. It was also called The Quiver, but the name was changed a few years later to The Quiver Junior, and still later to the Harding Herald, with the annual yearbook retaining the name of Quiver. In 1921, Vernon School was completed. An addition was made to that in 1929 and remodeled in 1955. This was used as a junior high school until 1953, then as an elementary school and until its closing in 1983, currently the site of the Vernon Condominiums.
Okay.
1921, North Main Street School was completed. Marion High School was renamed Harding High School in the year of 1921. In 1927, a broadcasting system for the intercommunication between rooms was installed at Central Junior High by Principal W.E. Orcott. It was believed to be the first in the nation. A lot of firsts going on with the school district.
Yeah, sure
was. Also in 1927, the first annual chorus and orchestra concert of the Marion Public Schools were held at the Chautauqua Pavilion with Howard Temple as the director. The performance included various overtures, 4 scenes from The Haunted House, and the cantata from Children of Hiawatha. Performing were 144 girl sopranos, 76 boy sopranos, 80 girl altos, and 50 boy altos, for a total of 350 voices.
Wow.
That's almost unheard of today. Accompanying were 91 instruments, including 6 pianos and 66 violins. And I think I'm going to stop at 1927, and we'll pick up the balance of this maybe the next time I come in.
That would be awesome.
And we'll probably talk about maybe some of the county schools at that time, because I see we're down to just a couple of minutes. And thought maybe we could, again, just kind of remind people that the Marion County Historical Society, the Heritage Hall, is open again for the balance of the season, which will conclude in December. And again, we're open from 1 to 4, Wednesday through Saturday. And you can just come up to the front door and come in and get your tickets right there. And that will also include entrance into the Wyandotte Popcorn Museum as well.
Okay, Fred Malone, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, Mike, we'll plan it for next month.
Most certainly. Always glad to have you on the air.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Wilson Show on WWGH.